From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1985 at a building complex overlooking the Genesee River Gorge. It's the former Rochester Brewing Company, and in 1985, a massive fire tore through the complex. Much of it was destroyed, some of it remained, and today you can see the office and the South Brewery buildings. The Landmark Society sees an opportunity there, and so the former Rochester Brewing Company complex makes the list for five to revive. It's an annual list of community needs and priorities, kind of a preservation and redevelopment wish list for the entire region, and it goes far beyond downtown Rochester. This year's list includes a downtown block in Perry, Wyoming County, and the Dove Block in Geneva, and it's our chance to find, or to dive in, I should say, to the reasons for these selections on the five to revive list. We have a lot of ground to cover. And again, no matter where you're listening today, I suspect you're not that far from either a 2016 Five to Revive site or something in some of the previous years, because this is the fourth year now that they've been doing it. And so let's go ahead and welcome our guests in studio. Wayne Goodman is here, the Executive Director of the Landmark Society. Wayne, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having us, Evan.
Larry Francer is the Associate Director of Preservation for the Landmark Society. Welcome, Larry.
Great to be here, Evan.
Caitlin Mivas is Preservation Planner for the Landmark Society. Caitlin, welcome back to you.
Thanks for having me.
Steve Jordan's here. He is an author of The Window Sash Bible. He's a preservationist. And he's worked in window restoration and as a repair craftsman for many years. Steve, welcome to you.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
And on the line with us is Erin Anheuer, who is an Orleans County resident, and she was an advocate, I say is an advocate, for Hillside Cemetery in Chapel. That was on the 2014 list. She's on the line with us now. Erin, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
We've got Erin on the line because we're going to be able to talk about the fact that as we go into, Wayne, again, fourth year now for the Five to Revive?
Correct.
All right, so now you've got a track record, and the idea is we're starting to be able to sort of measure how we've done in past years, and so I think Erin's going to be able to walk us through not only one of the sites from the past, but also talk about the importance of grassroots activism. But Wayne, is just as a basic backdrop, remind our listeners how this list comes together every year.
Sure. 4 years ago, our organization was searching for a way to become more proactive in leading sort of development focused on historic preservation. And so this list takes a look at, obviously we cast a broad net and we narrow it down to five properties, which is difficult. But the listings that appear on the list have significance, they have, they're opportunistic, and their property's usually in need. But we try to really focus on shed a positive light on these. Instead of picking a list and calling it an endangered properties list, we really try to focus on the fact that these are opportunities, and it deserves our attention because not only does it save a historic resource, but we feel like that there's a catalytic effect and the positive impacts would be substantial.
Can I just run down real quick the list of the five, and then we're going to kind of get into them in some details here. So on the list here, as I mentioned, the former Rochester Brewing Company complex in Rochester, the downtown Perry block of commercial buildings, that's in the village of Perry in Wyoming County, the Dove block in the city of Geneva, Lake Ontario State Parkway, covering both Monroe and Orleans counties, I think about a 35-mile stretch or so.
Right.
And then the fifth item, and I'll let anybody who wants to jump in and explain, because that's why Steve's here, is the traditional trades here. This is sort of a break from some of the usual on the list here. So how did you want to tell us what we mean by traditional trades here, Steve?
Well, the traditional trades are those trades that would be involved in historic preservation, rehab, or restoration. I don't mean to condescend, but most carpenters, modern carpenters, no matter how skilled they are, basically assemble pre-made materials. And so if you are not accustomed to working in old homes, you're not familiar with the materials that were used in old homes, the techniques that were used to make the materials and assemble the homes, then you get into unknown territory and a lot of mistakes are made. And so there are so many trades that are lacking. And Wayne said when we came in, there are so many tradespeople who are nearing retirement that we're concerned that the needs be met. These are trades like plastering, masonry, restoration carpentry, the decorative painting and decorative arts, sheet metal work, slate roofing. I can go on and on, Evan.
Leaded glass.
Leaded glass.
Sure.
Okay. That's,
yeah. All right. So let me go ahead and ask sort of an ignorant question, but my brain is going back to a conversation we had about the Chautauqua Institution and the amphitheater there. And there was a big community debate about can we keep the bones of this historic amphitheater and rebuild from within, or do we sort of tear it down and start new? That's one example of the kind of structures that every community has. Sometimes it's an old amphitheater, but sometimes it's a historic building, historic houses. And is it wrong to assume that if we don't have people with the skills that Steve is talking about, that the impetus is more likely to be, we'll just tear it down and start over, Wayne?
Well, that's a great question. And I think that anytime we look at a preservation project, there's usually some type of a mixture of, you know, new materials and historic fabric. But the whole aim of historic preservation is to try and save as much historic fabric as possible, whether or not it's a new use or a continued use that's in existence. And Steve, I think Steve makes an obvious point. If we do not have the craftspeople who are trained in how to intervene, so to speak, in needs related to historic fabric, then it becomes quite difficult to make those preservation projects a reality. Our offices, and Caitlin usually handles the phone calls that come in, we get droves of phone calls from people who need these types of craftspeople to conduct repairs on their houses, their places of business, whatever. And it's getting more and more difficult to find those people. And it's not a problem that's isolated to Rochester or Western New York. This is a problem all across the nation.
So we're talking about possible jobs here. If you have the marketable skills for this, we are talking about jobs in the future,
Steve? We're talking about jobs, and we're talking about high-paying jobs, all right? I actually brought a list of prevailing wages. Now, I know this is a little bit apples to oranges, but this list of wages for the building trades all runs in the $40, $50, and $60 an hour, okay? Not everyone would expect to make that, and that's the kind of money someone might make working for themselves. However, it's not uncommon for people working in the trades around here for someone else to make $20, $25 an hour if they're highly skilled. That's a great wage compared to working at the mall.
Absolutely. So what does putting this on the list, putting the traditional trades, putting this on the list means? What is the goal then? Are we talking about some kind of funding, training programs? You know, what is the goal of getting this as one of the five to revive? And I'll let any one of you tackle that where you want to here.
Well, I'll begin, but it would be nice if we could see the beginning of a trade program. We would need funding from several sources, but to see the beginning of a trade fund program that would either work with anyone interested in going into the trades, but particularly maybe inner city youth or any youth who need a direction. All right.
Okay.
Well, I agree, and I think that from our perspective, it's the knowledge and it's the skill gap that we're concerned about, and the first step is to call attention to that and to make sure we educate people that there is a need. And so for individuals, as Steve points out, whether they're currently living in a district that's plagued with poverty or questionable futures, we want people to understand that this is a skilled trade that is very valuable, that has increasing need, and that has prospects for an excellent future for that individual who pursues such a trade. And certainly the Landmark Society is interested moving forward, not only to encourage people to get into those trades and to work with craftspeople like Steve or Valerie O'Hara, who works at Pike Stained Glass, or whoever it may be, to learn the trade. But there's certainly a possibility, if we can secure funding from those sources that Steve mentions, that the Landmark Society could maybe sponsor workshops and training courses to get people excited and involved in the traditional trades.
And a lot of people are talking about this now. I mean, we know that Assemblymember Harry Bronson has a bill concerning training, and we're in discussion with him to see maybe how this can fit in as well. It's a problem that so many people are aware of, and it's such a great opportunity with our youth to really get them involved in a sustainable job.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, before I move to some of the others on the list then, Steve, can you give me just an example of the kind of work that, you know, what's an example of the kind of work that you're talking about? Let's say there is some kind of a structure, maybe something on this list, but maybe not, that needs this sort of trained work done, and some of the mistakes that can happen.
Okay.
In various, give me some examples.
That's good. I think that if we look in the phone book and we look around town, we see there are a lot of masons, but there are very few masons who are skilled in working with soft, old masonry and know how to say, repoint brick, soft, old brick, in a way that would last for another century. In contrast, they might do it incorrectly and damage the brick. Carpenters need to know about building materials, for example, old growth woods, what woods last, what woods don't last. So, for example, if we go to Home Depot and we buy ponderosa pine, we put it on the porch, it'll be rotten in 3 years. We need people that, well, I restore windows for a living, and there's a belief that new window, well, everything new is better than what was old, and it's not true. If you have a window that lasted 100 years, there's no reason that if it hasn't rotted that it won't last another 100 years. I can go on and on about these things, but I also think about roofing. There are very few people that know how to do slate roofs and sheet metal roofing and that sort of work, and it takes a lot of skill, and it's really hard work, and we don't have enough people doing that. So those are a few examples.
Does it surprise you, given the work that you've done in your career, Steve, to see so, I guess, for at least at this moment, so few younger people, especially in an economy where people are maybe lacking for jobs at decent wages, lacking for, you know, skilled and labor jobs, does it surprise you to see this kind of glut in the marketplace?
It does surprise me, and I don't really understand it. But I grew up working hard, and I don't find a lot of people willing to work in the trades. I think, unfortunately, they feel like it's a lesser path to success, or that people will look down on you, or you know, you walk around, you're dirty all day, and they're embarrassed about that sort of thing. But, you know, they need to get over it.
But there also has to be incentive to the craftspeople to take on these new young
That's a
people.
Good point, Larry, yeah. That's a problem.
And Evan, right. I think also part of the issue is, you know, if I can think back to the days when I was undergoing my sort of high school training, and, you know, that's getting harder and harder to remember. But it was really set up that if you're interested in the trades, then you're something less than those who are on a college-bound track. Mm-hmm. And that I just find that to be remarkable in that Steve points out that there's a lot of chemistry involved. There's a lot of science involved with compounds and masonry and so forth and the design. So I think we have to send a message that young people who are interested in the traditional trades and these very sort of niche markets have to be very highly skilled individuals. It's not a lesser sort of avenue. Mike Rowe, who did, you know, Dirty Jobs on CNN, he's been a proponent.
I felt like I was listening to Mike Rowe a moment ago, listening to Steve.
Yeah.
And, there was a lot of Mike Rowe in that comment there. But Mike Rowe does make that point often, that, you know, we are hurting our own economy and our own society if we look down our noses at people whose good-paying jobs involve getting their clothes dirty. Just like you said, Steve.
I agree.
Yeah, well said. So just to reset the conversation, we're talking about the Landmark Society's Five to Revive, and one of them is the traditional trades. Next year, it'll be Wayne Goodman's Memories of High School.
I don't know if I want to revive, though.
You want to check out the 2016 list. Wayne, where can people go to check out the list as we talk about this?
On our website, www.landmarksociety.org. And Caitlin updates that and has our website in good working order, all of our social media, Facebook, Twitter.
LandmarkSociety.org for the list here. So let me just kind of hit a few of the other points on the list here. And listeners, if you want to call in or comment on what you're hearing on this list, other thoughts on either past lists or what should be on future lists, I'm sure they are used to hearing from people on what people think should be revived. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Caitlin Mivas, the former Rochester Brewing Company complex, you've been there. Why is that on the list?
That is on the list because, you know, Rochester has this brewing history, and we've lost so much of the physical evidence of that history. This is one of maybe two brewery-related buildings that are left in the city. And Part of this complex has already been lost due to the fire that you mentioned at the beginning of the show. So this is a unique resource in the city, and It's right on the River Gorge. It's right on the edge of downtown. So we feel like it's really poised for a redevelopment opportunity. And, I mean, if you just go and stand in front of this building, you're wowed by it. It's a great building. And if I was independently wealthy, my dream in life would be to redevelop it into a beer garden. But we think it's an important building, and it's got a lot of potential.
When you're looking at a structure like this, Caitlin, how much do you have to assess? You know, it may be a beautiful structure to look at. It may hit you with the history. But given the fact that in 1985 you had this massive fire, I don't know the condition now. Do you consult with people to say, look, if this is on the list, is this a feasible sort of rehab from within as opposed to a tear down startup?
Yeah, that's a really important question to ask. And that's part of what we can do with this process is get that conversation going and ask those questions. We have a grant program called our Preservation Grant Fund, and we can help fund studies that will look at the feasibility and the costs of rehabbing a building like that.
Okay. Now, I want to remind listeners, as we talk about these individual sites and items on the list here, this is not a list for, hey, this is the five-year revive and government money magically lands in our coffers to deal with it. And in fact, it's people like Aaron Anheuer who make sure that there's a grassroots effort. So number one, if you're sort of digging this list, if you're thinking, oh, that history of brewing is interesting, this has really become a beer town, and what Caitlin's talking about is preserving one of the original parts of our beer history, it's the kind of thing where I'm sure they'd love to hear from you if you want to get more involved either with the Yups or with preservation efforts, or if you're independently wealthy and you'd like to give all your money to Caitlin and then let her use it. Getting in touch with the Landmark Society is easy at landmarksociety.org. Aaron Anheuer is someone who can tell us a little bit about a past project, because as we go down this list now, Aaron, 2014, it was the Hillside Cemetery and Chapel. Where is it? Where are you, by the way?
Well, we're at a very hopeful point at this point. By being on the 5 Revive, it brought a lot of attention to the building, helped us raise more community awareness, and also, I think, validated that it wasn't just a few people saying this was a wonderful building that needed to be saved, but that a respected organization like the Landmark Society was recognizing that this building has value. Through this publicity, we've not only gotten more people to volunteer in fundraising, to make donations, we've received some grants. In particular, we received a large grant through the State of New York Historic Preservation Office that actually is going to give us 50% of the cost of rehabilitating the building. Now, of course, we have to raise the other 50%, and we have to come up with the money first so that we can be reimbursed. But that is a great step forward, and we're currently under contract with the state. We hope to start the actual restoration work, perhaps some of it this winter, but definitely next year. And hopefully, by the end of next year, the chapel will be reopened, and we'll start using it for public events.
So, in other words, Aaron, it's not a stretch to say being on the 5 to Revive in 2014 had an impact that you feel like you can start to measure.
Oh, that's not a stretch at all. I really attribute to the Landmark Society's involvement and the success that we feel that is going forward right now.
We've touched a nerve, by the way, Steve Jordan. We've touched a nerve on Twitter and on the phones with putting the traditional trades on this list here. You know, Steven writes to us on Twitter. How can we as citizens regain the craftsmanship tradition that shaped our city? Where can we learn these skills? How much is it? Is there a short answer? Let me just back up and say, that's part of why, Stephen on Twitter, that's part of why the traditional trades was on their list. They want to see more emphasis, more support for training programs, et cetera. But is there a path for it right now, Steve, to get started with that kind of a career?
I think there's a path. I don't think there's a path for a lot of people, but I think there's a path by taking on an apprenticeship with restoration contractors. Unfortunately, our economy here is not the best economy in the world, so it's hard to find what you call a true restoration contractor. It's hard to make a living doing just that all day long, but there are a few around, and when they need help, it's hard to get help.
John on Twitter, too many college grads who can't pay student loans and not enough kids with marketable skills. That's what they're trying to change with this. And our phones are lit up on this subject. Chris in Rochester, I'll start with you. Go ahead, Chris.
Hi. You guys want to know why nobody wants to be a plumber or a carpenter or whatever. And I think I know. It's because when I was a teenager in high school, I'm a baby boomer, all of us were told, go to college, don't do
what
I did.
That's right.
Okay? So now, on top of the fact that you got nobody wanting to be a plumber, nobody wanting to be a mechanic, a carpenter, or whatever, they all went to college to do to not be that, but also to get out of going to the war. So, you know, you got a whole bunch of people now who even perceive that someone who is a carpenter or a plumber or et cetera, just isn't as good as them. So they're perpetrating this fallacy, this feeling that they got from their, in many cases, immigrant parents, that, you know, doing that kind of work just isn't cool. And I really, truly feel that that is it. I mean, you sit there and you look at them all, I don't want to be a plumber. But then you look, I mean, the last time the plumber came by to do something in your house, spare me. You know, I mean, I realize it's not the greatest, funnest work to do, but, you know, because it's not the greatest, funnest work to do, you get paid good for it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Chris, you're on the money there. And by the way, even plumbers with special skills. There is a sinkhole in my backyard right now. I almost fell through it. And the town came out, and they're calling. They have a list of plumbers who are specialized to figure out, is that a cistern or an old collapsed well or an old collapsed septic system that goes back to, you know, 4 or 5 decades? Nobody really knows. It's quite an interesting thing, and it's going to take a skilled trade. That's in my backyard right now. Imagine all around this region. But I'm with you, Chris. I think we all need to make sure that we don't make anyone feel lesser for it. And I know Steve feels very strongly about this, but go ahead.
I have an interesting insight into that. I lived for a few years in Boulder, Colorado, which is a wealthy community. And among the people there, if you were a tradesperson, you were almost a movie star, okay? People just would almost fight to have you come work for them if you did good work. I moved there directly to Oklahoma, which was incredibly poor where I went. And you no matter how cheaply you did something, there was someone that would do it for less, and it was really a tough way to go. All right.
Evan, I think that Chris's point, which I sort of mentioned a little bit earlier about the whole educational track, particularly in our high schools, I recall back, you know, my parents, who I respected immensely, it was always, you know, you're going to college. But my father would always call attention to the fact that I needed to know how to change my oil. I needed to know how to do basic wiring and plumbing. And the messages, I guess, that Chris was pointing out that I was receiving in high school was, no, you don't. You need to go to college. Those skills are for, quote, you know, someone else or other people. And now that, you know, I've sort of grown older, boy, how much do I wish that I would have taken my father's advice and really learned and broadened my skills, because now, you know, it's something I wish that I had. And there's so many different career paths that are just simply going unfilled. And that's just the truth of the matter.
I hope East Rochester High School, by the way, which is now requiring Life 101 for high school seniors before graduation, financial literacy, things like that, it should be fixing a tire and some of the basics, whether it's for a career or not. But a well-taken point there. Marty in Kingsbury next up. Go ahead, Marty.
Yeah, hi. I had a question. I have I kept my parents' house, which is an old, old farmhouse, and it has a stone foundation that's not a cut stone, and it has a soft lime mortar, and I cannot find to buy it anywhere. And I've gone online and looked, and you can make it up, but I don't know if I have the ability to. I have done work on the foundation, but I've used Portland, and I would like to know if there's any local area that has this soft lime product for old, old buildings.
I'll answer that. No, you can't buy it. You have to make it. But I know a mason or two that would make it up for you if you needed them to do it, okay?
So
you can call the Landmark Society, and they'll get back to me.
Okay, can you give me the phone number for the Landmark Society?
I think it's 546-7029.
Yep,
ask
right.
for Caitlin.
I'm going to do it again for you, Marty. 546-7029, and only Caitlin is the person you need to talk to.
Straight to Caitlin.
Thank you, Marty. Tim in Pittsford next up. Go ahead, Tim.
Evan, I am in the skilled trades, and after I finally matured or grew up, realized that that was the path that I should be going. And honestly, I'm not bragging. It's just, it is what it is, but I make more money than anyone else in my family, immediate family, and it's a good living. And I know your other caller said it's not the most fun, or it's really interesting work. And from, let's say, a real world point of view, coming home, I don't know how many thousands of dollars I've saved by being able to wire my house, install fixtures, do plumbing, things like that. And on the side, have people come to me and say, can you do this for me? And being paid for that as well. And then I hear from people who just say, oh, God, I could never do that, or I would never know how to do that. Now, these are the people that I'm taking money from to do the work. And, you know, you see a lot of kids getting their education now, and you see the degree they get, which is, I'm sorry, but sometimes just a piece of toilet paper, because you see the degrees that are offered, and you feel bad for them because you're wondering what they're going to do with this besides earn $10 an hour. And not enough people are told, not enough kids are just told in school, you know, college isn't the right path for you. Maybe you would like to have a more hands-on certificate, or, you know, an apprenticeship, something like that. And I don't even, you know, it's too bad that it takes a show like this to get to that point, because I don't see that changing a whole lot. I think most kids are still steered towards college when there's so many more opportunities to earn a really good living. So thanks, Evan.
Yeah, Tim, thanks for the phone call. Go ahead, Wayne.
You know, Tim, I think Tim's point about the whole the fun aspect,
right,
or the enjoyment aspect.
Yep.
You know, certainly, I think any job that pays you money to do the job, there's going to be some unpleasantry associated with the job. However, one thing that I always hear we obviously deal with a lot of contractors at the Landmark Society, and in my career, I've worked with all sorts of contractors. And I think the craftspeople, at the end of the day, particularly the ones in the traditional trades, you can go out and do a job, and when you leave, you see immediate improvement in what you've done. Mm-hmm. You have a strong sense of accomplishment. And in a way, it's sort of from the input I get from craftspeople, it's almost as an artist feels. They create something. They're doing something that others can't do. And that's a very fulfilling feeling, I think, for a career. There's a passion behind it.
Well, I'm getting that panicky feeling of looking at the clock going, oh, my gosh, we haven't. But the phones are still. So let me just get one more call before we get our only break of the hour, and then we're going to shift our attention to some of the other items on the list, Geneva, Perry, the Ontario State Parkway. But before I do that, Scott in Canandaigua wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Scott.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to get your response to. I've been restoring buildings in Rochester for probably 35 years now, and we actually replace the original material with new composites. So if there's a deteriorated cornice out of metal that's all rusted, we'll either re-sculpt a new one or take a mold directly off the building and then replace that with a composite, with fiberglass. And I know there's some ethical issues about that, where, in my opinion, a lot of times they wouldn't be able to afford to replace it in the original material, but we aren't, quote, historically correct using a composite material, but in fact we are saving the building aesthetically. So I wanted to know what the thoughts are using some of the newer materials replacing the old material.
Well, Scott, every job is a compromise, isn't it, between what the customer wants and what the customer can afford to pay. Having said that, I don't believe I've worked for many people in my whole life who've said, I want a mediocre job. They always want the best job, but they're not always willing to pay for it. I think using composite materials is all right, as long as they have at least some track record of durability. We do know a lot of materials that have not had a good track record, like masonite, but it's one of those things that we have to learn about and use and try to determine as time goes on. For example, I know a lot of people are using AZAC right now. In some applications, it's not so good. In other applications, it works terrific, okay? There's hardy plank. You can go on and on, but there have been a lot of failures. There have been a lot of concrete slate roof materials that failed terribly. So, you know, as time goes by, we learn what will work and what won't work, and we just have to judge from what we know.
Very good. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for the phone call, Scott. Mm-hmm. Justin on Twitter on this issue says, when it comes to the traditional trades, which of course is on that list of the five to revive for the Landmark Society, Justin writes, important that, quote, college isn't right for all kids doesn't become race or class-based coding. Yeah, I take that point, and yep. I take that point, Justin. But I think what we've heard from Tim and Steve and so many others is this isn't just the Landmark Society or Steve or anybody else saying this is for people who maybe can't afford college or people in urban settings, et cetera. This is for anybody who wants
I'd like to make a comment about that. I work with a team of really terrific craftspeople. One of them is an engineer from Carnegie Mellon. One of them is an architect from Syracuse. Another one has a degree in a master's degree in business from the U of R. I can go on and on and on about the people that I work with who have high-end educations and they've chosen to do this, and it's gratifying to them.
And Steve won't mention it, but Steve has a master's degree from Cornell in historic preservation. Yeah. So I think that, again, I think that's a myth. I think it's a myth that somehow people in the traditional trades are somehow lesser than engineers and architects and so forth. You'll find a lot of engineers and architects getting into these trades because of, again, the sense of accomplishment and quite frankly, the pay. I've met some people in my career that do these jobs that do incredibly well financially.
It'd be very interesting when we sit here 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now to see how this being on the list for the Five to Revive 2016 has impacted. Is there more training? Is there more emphasis on the traditional trades? You want to read more about it and see what else is on the list? It's coming next, or you can check out landmarksociety.org. We're going to go down to Geneva, Perry, the Parkway, and more next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with the Green Party candidate for U.S. Senate. It's Robin Laverne Wilson. She's challenging Chuck Schumer, and she and the Green Party want to make it clear. She is not just a more liberal version of Chuck Schumer. There are real policy disagreements on many issues. We're going to talk about that and why she says every policy should be earth first. What does that mean? The Green Party candidate for U.S. Senate next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. In studio, you've been hearing from Steve Jordan. He is the author of The Window Sash Bible. He has been in window restoration and repair craftsmanship for years as a preservationist, and he's been talking to us about the traditional trades. Wayne Goodman, Caitlin Mivas, Larry Francer, all here from the Landmark Society as we talk about the 2016 Five to Revive. And on Twitter, P. McKay says, very happy to hear the Landmark Society's Five to Revive goes beyond. It shows the importance of our rural communities. It's a regional approach. So P. McKay on Twitter says thumbs up for that. And one example is Geneva. So I want to bring in Sage Gerling, who's the director of neighborhood initiatives in the city of Geneva. Hi again, Sage. How are you?
I'm great. Glad to be on the call.
Well, we're talking about Geneva. And Sage, you want to tell us about the Dove? Is it the Dove building, the Dove block here? I've got this stack. It's the Dove block. Tell us about what's on the list in Geneva, Sage.
So the Dove Block is one of our signature buildings. It was built around 1878 by William Dove, and it's kind of an example of high Victorian Gothic. The other really fun thing about the building is William Dove's son, Arthur Dove, was the first abstract impressionist painter, and he painted from the third floor. And so we've got two really vibrant things going for the building, and it's, I think the third thing that is really empowering is that there's an initiative that is being led by citizens to activate the building. So this is kind of a revitalization at the core of, you know, community engagement. So a HWS professor emeritus, Jim Spates, and a local kind of builder, Dave Bunnell, started this charge, and quite quickly afterwards, I would say a large group, and it keeps growing, of citizens that have said, yes, we want to revitalize this building. You know, we will get help from, you know, the city and hopefully the state and private investment. But I think the exciting part about the Dove Block is that kind of grassroots effort.
This is it's the Dove Block Restoration Group, and this is another example of the question I often have with these targets on the Five to Revive, which is who owns it? Who does own it right now, Sage?
So this is the Save the Dove Block Group, which they formed a not-for-profit. They are in a lease to own with the former owner. So they have kind of the authority behind the building and the power to actually make the building active again and do the rehab that's needed for it. Eventually, they are looking at several different models, but one being a kind of a condo where you would sell commercially off the floors to different entities.
I love what's going on in Geneva. We had a listener one time tell me that Evan in Geneva just needs to get a room. I know. there's a lot of great things happening there. What's the best case with this, though, Sage? You look at the Dove Block and you think, I don't know if it's a, you know, if it's too ambitious to ask you in 3 years, but in 5 or 10 years, what's the best case of what's going on there?
The lights would be on at every floor, including the basement. So the third floor is being reserved as a memorial and museum for Arthur Dove, and that is, you know, part of the ambition of the group is to focus on the third floor. The first and second floor and even the basement, they're looking at different options. So whether it's a commercial entity on the first floor or residents on the second floor or commercial on both or nonprofits on both, that is yet to be determined, but the first goal in the next few years is to get the building ready and kind of fit out for any possibility. And then they will, hopefully in 5 years, all floors will be activated and occupied.
Let me ask our guest in studio, what drove you to put this on that final list of five, Larry?
Well, first of all, we have the same love affair with Geneva. We've written articles in our magazine about them. Linden Street is amazing. We have some wonderful preservationists there. And we were very, very impressed with the DRI award, the Downtown Revitalization Initiative Award. I mean, they are a community that is really doing great things and thinking outside the box. And those are the type of communities that we want to go to see what else they need. And the fact that they did have a grassroots group working on it, it's always so important when we're looking at the different possibilities for Five to Revive.
Okay. Sage, before I let you go, because we want to dive into the last two projects we haven't even touched yet, are you trying to grow this grassroots group? I mean, if people, whether they live in Geneva, maybe they live in the Finger Lakes and they care about preservation efforts, are you trying to grow this group that's working on this project?
Absolutely. It will take all hands on deck. So if people are interested, that they can contact City Hall or myself to learn more, and I will connect them with the group.
Again, it's the Dove Block Restoration Group with that. And thank you, Sage. I know this is exciting for you guys, and there's so much happening. So thanks for making time for Connections today.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Sage Gerling is the Director of Neighborhood Initiatives in the City of Geneva. The Dove Block, just one of the five on the 2016 Five to Revive. And you heard from P. McKay on Twitter, who said, thank you for making this truly regional. Well, P. McKay works with the it's Shake on the Lake down there.
Shake on the Lake.
So
what a great
Larry
project.
Francer is a big Perry advocate.
Right.
You know, so
we
you and Perry need to get a room, I think.
Right. Yeah.
So tell me about what's going on in Perry and how Perry ended up on this list of the five to revive.
Again, we look at these communities. We look at the villages and towns and cities that are really innovative and see what they need. And from the time I got here, from the 4 years ago, Wayne and I went down to meet with their Main Street organization, Main Street Perry, and this was a problem. This block was blighted, and there was a very difficult situation with the owner. And when we heard that it had actually been up for auction and Greg McConnell had taken on a few of the buildings, and we know the wonderful work that he has done around the region, specifically in Mount Morris, we just thought this is the opportunity to really shine on Perry and what they can use.
Perry, you know, I would also say that the economic forces that our small villages and towns are hit with, they were never designed or intended to be, I guess, dealing with these economic forces. And so one of the ways that these small villages and towns can overcome some of their challenges, which sort of the flight from and the jobs leaving these small towns, is through preservation. It's not the only way, but it's certainly one avenue. And both Geneva and Perry are doing that. And the mayor of Perry, Rick Hauser, is doing a phenomenal job to make sure that preservation is included in their urban planning.
And the first time I was down in Perry, just loved the visit down there. And Mayor Hauser, if you're listening, we should get together sometime on the show and talk more about these efforts, because there's a lot happening there. So you can check that out. By the way, who's the owner in this case, or what's the situation in terms of what it would take to green light more of some of these efforts?
For the block in Perry, there's a couple different owners. As Larry said, Greg O'Connell, a developer, has acquired a couple of them, I think two or three of them. And so then there's some mixed ownership. So it's going to definitely take a community-wide strategy to get these buildings in better shape. But, you know, one building, once success with one building will hopefully catalyze success with others.
Okay. So Perry is the number four that we've been talking about. And the last one on the list is, again, this is, they like to surprise you a little bit. I was a little surprised. is it fair to say this is a little bit of a surprise, guys?
Sure.
It's the Lake Ontario State Parkway, stretching from Orleans to Monroe County, about 35-mile parkway. And why? Why this stretch here?
So in preservation, even though the majority of our work deals with buildings, we don't strictly focus on just buildings. We in the past have included cultural landscapes such as the Hillside Cemetery and the pedestrian bridges designed by the Olmsted firm in Genesee Valley Park. So this is, you know, in line with the types of things that we focus on. But we had been hearing from folks in Orleans County about the Lake Ontario State Parkway. Actually, Aaron, who we had on the phone earlier, who's on our Five to Revive committee, brought it to our attention and said, this is a concern locally. You know, we want to see something happen with the parkway. It's a great cultural landscape, a great asset for both Monroe and Orleans counties, and it's got some unique historic resources along it. And it's the only parkway in our region. We see these parkways downstate. They were very common. But here upstate, this is the only one we have. So it's an important regional asset.
You have the sad picture of the parkway, you know, so showing, I think, both the potential but also the current condition, which is, I mean, just sad because the grass is brown. And you've got a somewhat beautiful-looking bridge, but you wonder about the condition. So, and so I guess what's the hope here? What is a best case for this kind of a redevelopment?
Discussion.
I think that this with this particular listing, because I think it did surprise a few people, and I think in a positive way, when this was announced on our Five to Revive list, it's no secret that this New York State and probably every other state in the nation is struggling with its transportation infrastructure. So the idea is to make sure that we point a finger at this resource and let folks know that it's significant, that there's a lot of opportunity there. Because when those resources, which we fully admit are scarce, when those get appropriated, that they're appropriated in the right way. I think with this resource, there's certainly room to discuss some type of planning on the parkway that maybe you alter it in some way, shape, or form. Maybe it's used in a different way, or a portion of it is used in a different. Maybe it goes from four lanes to two lanes. Maybe you add bike trail. I don't know. I mean, there's a need for a broad discussion on that. But the idea would be if maybe there's some plan to move forward that would reduce the amount needed and required for maintenance, and then that would be a plus for the state. And at the same time, you would encourage tourism and cultural activities along that parkway.
Okay. And if those kind of things happen, again, does it come from community groups, grassroots groups? Does it come from municipalities? Who helps make that happen?
Well, I think now it's all the above. I think that now the problem, one of the problems, I think, is the fact that there's a lack of consensus. And so we're entering the discussion, admittedly, maybe a little late. But part of what we want to do is try and at least build some type of consensus and agreement along those various parties that you just outlined, because there's a lot of different strong feelings about what to do and how to proceed.
Landmarksociety.org if you want to check out the Five to Revive. And as we mentioned, this is the fourth year they've been doing it. And if you look back in past years, you know, not every one of the – I guess you're at 15 previous, so you're at 20 now. And the you've had 25 to revive so far. So that's quite sort of a database of opportunities to go back and look through. And you mentioned a few off the top, but, you know, I know you also feel good about things like Eastman Gardens. Can you tell us a little bit more about some of the projects that stand out from past lists, or at least a sense for how things are going there?
Well, I would just say that my personal favorite would be the Eastman Gardens. The Eastman Dental Dispensary, that was on our first list, our first five to revive, and when we announced that, people, I got comments that we were totally insane. That building was way too far gone. There was no way it was going to be preserved. It was in deplorable condition. Edgemere Development and Home Leasing really got involved. We worked with the state. Brett Garwood at the time was very, very helpful, who worked for the city. And that's just such a heavy lift, Evan. It's one of my personal favorites in my entire career because it was so close to being demolished. The city... John Strawway, I know, was working back several years ago on the preservation board when it came up for demolition, and the city took a stand to save the building. So it's just a great preservation story, and the reuse is incredible. It's affordable senior housing. It's exactly what we need. It's going to be a shot of enthusiasm.
And the same group, Edgemere and Home Leasing, are now looking at Holly High School, which was on our second list, which is also a really heavy lift.
Yeah,
everybody
really
said to
building
us.
Really big building that's been vacant for decades.
You guys, when I came here, the big save was Hallman Chevrolet. Can you imagine Hallman Chevrolet being gone? I can't.
Spot Coffee, right?
Right.
Yeah. So, all right. So those are some examples there. And before we go here, just a couple more listener questions. Anne writes to us and says, "Great to hear Five to Revive. Greetings from the heart of Perry. Our built history is rich, and we love it." Thank you for that, Anne. And an email from Mark who just says, "Evan, the issue when it comes to skilled trades is that too often we've been telling kids that if you go into those kind of trades, you're not going to be educated, and you can be both." So, Steve, how do you feel about that, Steve?
I think that's true. Like I said, I work with a team of people who all have terrific educations but decided they wanted to work in the trades. I guess they decided they'd rather work for themselves, and they all are happy, and they lead good lives, and I think that's a good point.
You know, there's nothing wrong with laying brick and, you know, humming Mozart and quoting Shakespeare.
That's right.
Right? There's nothing wrong with that.
I have a cousin drives a tractor all day. He's a farmer, and he listens to classical music all day, and Cynthia at the Landmark Society finds that hard to believe.
Can't throw someone under the bus when not here to defend themselves. But okay. Josh writes to us and says, "Love the parkway. I go to Grand Island often and just love taking the parkway to Route 18. Beautiful bridges on the parkway." So maybe that's a good place to end here. When you drive, he's talking about the drives he makes on the parkway. When we drive through the Finger Lakes, we see dilapidated barns, but beautiful barns. And so often, you hear these family debates over knock it down or preserve it, et cetera. I mean, were you smiling over that
one? No, it's painful to me.
But what's painful about it?
The dilapidated barns. It's painful to me because agriculture is not what it once was.
Oh, sure.
And
yeah,
there's just no money, really. Yeah. You know, and there's no money, free money. And so the people that own these barns can't really afford to keep them up. And it may be sort of fun to see them in advanced stages of decay, but eventually they'll be gone.
No, absolutely. I don't take any pleasure in seeing them come in. In fact, you can envision when they were at their peak, and they're beautiful structures.
Yeah.
For the most part, are they savable when you drive and you see them in these?
Oh, kind of some are, some aren't. You know, it all depends on the bones. If the roof's caved in, they usually aren't savable.
We need more people like Steve, though, who can help make those
assessments.
Exactly.
That's right.
And so I just want to thank all of you for being here and not only kind of running down the list of the five to revive, but inspiring the conversation. Very, very clear. Wayne was saying, I think, during our brief break, that there, when you put the trades on this list, even at your news conference, there was an audible gasp. Huh?
We had a press conference, and I guess, you know, we knew, the committee knew that when we had when we came up with this list, that there were two particular, the Parkway, and it's very unique. And Traditional Trades is unique, and it's gotten great response.
Well, yeah, very exciting.
Let's see what happens. LandmarkSociety.org to follow along with it. And thank you so much. And Steve, thank you for sharing your expertise and
good
your time
to be
here.
Great thank
to
you,
have
Evan.
You. Caitlin, yeah. Wayne, Larry, great to have you as well from the Landmark
great to
Society.
Be here. Thank
great
you.
To be here.
All right, short break. Much more Connections next.